today on Raising Your Paws, why it's so hard to take photos of cats' eyes, then the kinds of stress that dogs and cats feel and how to lessen it, plus the best game ever to play with your dog. Welcome. This is Raising Your Paws, easy tips and practical solutions for caring for the four-legged members of the family. Presented by Nutrisource Pet Foods, a family like no other. I'm your host, Susan Frank. This is episode 104. We're still celebrating reaching 100 episodes by giving away 3 months of free pet food to 2 lucky winners through the month of October. For your chance to win, please leave a comment about one of the 100th shows on the episode page on the website, RaisingYourPaws.com, or you can mention the podcast on our Raising Your Paws Facebook page. Then we'll randomly select 2 winners from the comments. Our new podcast producer is Talk North, the largest sports, outdoor, and lifestyle podcast network in the Upper Midwest. Check them out at TalkNorth.com. Have you tried to take photos of your cat in low light? If so, you'll know that most often the pictures show their eyes as being just bright, shining yellow circles. Why is this? The answer lies within the dark conditions themselves. Cats in the wild, by nature, hunt in dim light, so they need to have super sharp vision to spot mice scuttling about in the grasses in the evenings. Felines developed the adaptation of having an extra layer of tissue behind their retinas. Just so you know, the retina is a membrane in the back of the eye that receives light impulses through the lens and then sends information to the brain. The extra special layer in their eyes is called the tapetum lucidum, and it acts like a mirror reflecting light that was not absorbed the first time it passes through the retina. This greatly improves a cat's night vision. So, next time you are out walking at night, like on Halloween, which is coming up soon, and you see spooky, glowing eyes peering out at you from the bushes, you can probably guess that it's a cat. Or it could be a dog, or a cow, or a horse. Some of the other animals that have tapetum lucidums.
We all hear about how stress can wreak havoc with our health, and perhaps you've experienced times when stress has made you sick. Did you know that your dog or cat also experiences stress and that it can affect their health? My guest this week is Dr. Paul McCutcheon, a doctor of veterinary medicine and is the author of The New Holistic Way for Dogs and Cats, The Stress Health Connection, written with Susan Weinstein. Today, he will help us identify the different types of stress your pets may experience, what effects the stress can have on their health, and most usefully, let us know what we can do to prevent and manage some of that stress. Dr. McCutcheon, I am thrilled to have you on the show today.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure.
Dr. McCutcheon practices holistic pet care at Toronto's East York Animal Clinic, which he also founded in 1962. It is hard for many people to grasp the concept that stress has a negative effect on our own health. And even if we do get it, we often take the attitude, well, we simply just have to accept it in our lives, and there's not much we can do about it anyway. How then, doctor, shall we begin to understand the importance and relevance of stress in our pets?
Well, first of all, I think the understanding of what stress really is. And I don't mean just the emotional stress. Most of our connotation of stress is, oh, it's the emotional side.
Right.
That certainly is a factor. But it's not the factor. The real factors are that stress is an overall effect on the body. And I define it by saying it's really the reaction of the body to demands from the environment. And those effects on the body manifest themselves in a variety of different ways. So it may be affecting us psychologically or our pets psychologically, or it may be manifesting itself in a physical level. Of course, it's showing up with cancer or autoimmunes, all sorts of different manifestations. But the real essence of it is that it is nonspecific, and it depends on the individual, how they're going to respond to that. So it's up to the us as pet owners and I shouldn't use that word, probably pet companions would be more appropriate. really what we are trying in the book to try to make people better companions to their pet by understanding how they possibly can control the stress factors that may be influencing their lives.
And you state in your book that you believe that stress is the sole cause of everything that happens to our pet's health.
Well, yeah, the way I look at it is this. The body, the terrain, the body of what we're really talking about is a magnificent instrument. And it is functioning beautifully under normal circumstances. We should not see illness. We should not see degeneration. We should not see anything happening to that body if things are working the way they should. When things, but you and I know that realistically for our own bodies and our pets, that is a impossible situation for the rest of your life, for most people anyhow. So there are factors that interfere with that normality. And that the body is constantly fighting for normality or homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that disturb that homeostasis. And those factors are stress. So, of course, we need stress to have a normal, happy, functional life. If we didn't have any stress whatsoever, we would be basically static. We'd be dead, if you will.
So, that wouldn't be good at all.
we wouldn't have much fun. So stress is a very positive thing or a very negative thing. The interesting thing is that the same stress might be different for individuals. Give you an example. Maybe a positive stress for a big, strong, healthy Labrador Retriever is a 2-mile walk. That same 2-mile walk to an overweight couch potato Cocker Spaniel may be life-threatening. I mean, they just can't handle that same thing. So in that case, the same walk turns into a negative stress. But the positiveness that we get out of stress is very, very important to understand, too. So we have to balance and understand what is negative and positive in our pets' lives and try to avoid the negative side, obviously.
Okay, and as we talk today, it would be wonderful if you can also use some of the stories of the cats and dogs that you've treated.
I have a friend whose cat has a case of dermatitis where she has licked all the fur off of her front leg. There's been lots of visits to the vet, but we're wondering, could this be stress-related? You've seen cases like this, haven't you?
Many of them, and this is a typical stress reaction. You know, you look at that and you say, oh, there might be some mites or something,
mm-hmm.
as you say in the caption. But obviously, most of them are negative. You see nothing. You see that he's been, or he or she has been licking herself consistently, and that's, she had a very rough tongue. Cats have real rough tongues. If you've ever had them lick you, you understand that.
Yes.
That constant licking is created a real scar tissue and what have you that you see on that on the screen. Now, the problem with this is that there is an emotional factor there. It's like people biting fingernails. It turns into a vice, and it's an ongoing thing. That case would be a very difficult thing to sort out from a purely medical standpoint. You have to start looking at the psychological side, the whole behavioral thing, the fact that this cat probably has some emotional stress factors in that family. So I spend time trying to confront the owner with possible emotional or possibly physical stress factors that might be involving that particular individual. It's a bit of a challenge sometimes, and to be truthful, you get into people's lives.
Yes, and of course you go into much detail about what you mean by the new holistic way, and that it's looking at the whole entire animal, not just some of what we're used to in traditional medicine that just looks at the symptoms and then tries to, you know, treat the symptoms.
Right, and I expand that to the environment as well.
Yes.
I mean, particularly in a guest like this, that cat would probably have owners, companions, if you will, human companions, with emotional problems. Maybe they're having a marital problem. You know, this type of thing is, believe me, they pick up on all those things so dramatically, particularly cats. Cats are, sixth sense to speak of. They know what's going on in our minds. I mean, we have two cats right here and looking at me. I know that the one cat reads my mind.
Remind me, what are the three classical responses an animal will have to a stressor?
So when we start talking about how they respond, the fight and flight hormone.
Mm-hmm.
They respond by either attacking the situation, they respond by just living with it, or they respond by running away from the situation. I mean, this is how it is. And that can be transmitted even how they handle infections. Really, there are many factors in life where this stress reaction occurs. And this may be such a simple thing as boredom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of our pets probably don't get enough attention. And this is a real stress factor. Now, dogs and cats both. I mean, people tend to think that cats don't need the attention. And they make their isolationist and so on and so forth. I don't believe that. I think they really do need our interaction, our attention. Admittedly, they run their own show, but more so than dogs. But still, they need our interaction.
I agree.
Like a cat, stress, remember, is the reaction of the body to environmental demands.
And I love that definition. It's very clear and very understandable.
So then how that terrain is going to respond to that is the issue. And it may manifest itself in a variety of different ways. An aggressiveness, yes. Even a behavioral thing might be very aggressive or maybe passive, or they become very reclusive, right?
Yes.
So you have all of those possibilities to stress as a simple example of how the body may respond to those things.
Now, I want to focus a little bit more on emotional stress, Doctor. Now, you haven't mentioned this, but here's something that is one of my particular concerns and things that I like to speak about on my show. And you stated very clearly, and I'm going to quote from you, "As I have learned from many years in my veterinary practice, boredom and loneliness are probably the most damaging factors in a pet's life." So what should we be trying to do about that?
Well, of course, the idea, let's face it, most families now spend way too much time in front of their computers and television as well. And it's just that we should try to realize that our pets really do need our attention. And they're a very unique possession. They're the only possession that you have that really requires your active involvement to be healthy. And they're so unique in that way that they need that special attention no matter what. So I just want to encourage people. There's so much too many people who, under certain circumstances, work related, family related, I realize that tend to make their pets lonely. And I really feel the manifestation of that is a vicious circle, because they get stressed out. They can't express that stress in any other way than perhaps detrimental. They may chew up the furniture or whatever. And it's really not them that's at fault. It's
mm-hmm.
the environmental, emotional side of it that's an ongoing problem. And people have to realize that.
I know that in our own ignorance and innocence, we're so used to our pets being so self-sufficient and suffering in silence, I guess is what we'd say, that we think they are fine. But as you say, we've really got to tune into what can we do if the dogs are and the cats are exhibiting some behaviors that you go into that may indicate that, there is a problem. There is another kind of stress our pets experience that has to do with them being over-medicated, called iatrogenic stress. What is that?
Iatrogenics are drug-induced problems. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And we see a lot of this. And I'm sure that anybody who's listening to this will appreciate this particular problem. We are inundated with pharmaceuticals that are supposed to keep our dogs and cats healthy. And I'm talking about systemic insecticides, vaccines, and many, many medications that are just routine things that are automatically given. There's a downside to practically every one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And there are individuals that are going to react negatively to all of them. Case in point, systemic insecticide, selumectin is one of the most common ones. It's all over the world. It's used in particularly for dogs. It's everywhere.
Are we talking about Dr. getting rid of fleas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, for fleas and other parasites. The medication, if you look on the Food and Drug Administration the website, they have selumectin and all the complaints about selumectin, in other words, the side effects. And they're in the thousands and thousands and thousands. So I looked a long time ago and there was 11,000 cases documented. Now, how many would be reported? I mean, 10% or 100% or 1%, I don't know. But there's lots and lots of reactivity to the selumectin. But that means that there's a certain percentage of the, particularly the dogs, that are reactive negatively to that medication. And the manifestation of that may be a simple thing as diarrhea or it could be death. It's all over the map, and that's important. So there are a certain percentage of those animals that are reactive to that medication. We have to realize that if your pet does not respond well to that medicine, I have people all the time come in and they say, yeah, I gave him that drug, I don't even dispense it, and he slept for 2 days afterwards, or he didn't feel well. Well, that's causing a negative reaction. How will that manifest itself later on? It could manifest as severe illness, and we wouldn't know it. We wouldn't know. But to keep giving that drug over and over again, that's a simple example of that. Vaccine, over-vaccination all the time. We see this annual vaccine thing done, and we're just getting around to thinking, well, maybe this isn't an annual event. What we do in our clinic is we only vaccinate against absolute minimal number of things, the things that are really important to me. In the case of the dog, it's distemper and parvo. In the case of the cat, it's panleukopenia. Other than rabies, which is unfortunately a necessity legally, those are the only vaccines that we do. And we only do them as a puppy, for instance, or a kitten. And then after that, we measure antibody levels. So we do a titer test to see if their immunity is there. Now, I can tell you from years and years and years of doing this, over 99% of our animals never need another vaccine the rest of their life.
So, and you go into this in detail in your book. Would you recommend, doctor, that all pet owners just need to talk to their own vets about what the procedures
absolutely.
Should be?
I think they should get some really good handle. I mean, obviously it may differ with the different parts of the country, what is currently there. I'm talking about from my practice. But it may be a little different, but there's got to be a pretty darn good reason for somebody, for instance, to use Lyme disease vaccine. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a bunch of cases of Lyme disease to really be able to feel comfortable on using a vaccine like that. Well, that potentially is a dangerous thing to be putting into a dog system. And there may be a few parts of the country where it is a good idea.
Let's talk then about what is it that we can do really to help know the stress that our pets may be encountering and then what to do about it. And what I really found very useful was your teaching us how to be our own pet's stress monitors. And you were talking about us using our five senses and what's important for us to keep in mind about what our animals may be smelling.
Well, that's very true, and I'm glad you bring pointed out, smell. They rely on their scent mechanism, of course, so much more than we do, and and often we have a polluted environment for them. And you start spraying things, for instance, around the house, and you never think about it, but they may be horrendous things for the dog system. Remember the dog and the cat. We keep forgetting the cat here, don't we?
Well, we'll bring up our kitties and we're talking about them.
Sorry about that. But the cats and dogs spend their life on the floor. And, you know, we tend to spray stuff and use deodorants and what have you. And the after effects of that go right on the floor and they're involved in that. So they're smelling things that we, and it may be totally obnoxious to them. I mean, they're astute at doing this. And it may be even physically detrimental. Of course, there's a lot of pollutants. You know, there was a survey done and analyzing the pollutants in a dog and cat in a regular family with the pet owners. And this was done professionally and scientifically, and it was proved that our pets are more polluted, much more polluted with potential carcinogens, for instance, than the owners. That's a very disturbing thing, but in some ways it's understandable. They're down on the floor, they're down on the grass. You know, we spray our grass with some stuff, and where they're out there being polluted. And you have to think about that. So smell, pollution, or odors, absolutely.
And you impress how important it is then to provide fresh air on a regular basis for
absolutely.
Our pets.
Absolutely. They should be considered. That's one of those things that we have to take into account.
Okay, and what do you hear? And this also gave me pause, that some of the sounds that we think are absolutely normal and that we adjust in our life could be causing stress for animals. But so we have to pay attention to what kind of sounds could be causing stress.
Particularly where they're located. I mean, they're sitting perhaps in front of a television set, and there's a lot of noise associated with that television that they don't even want. And maybe that's where their bed is, you know. We have to think about it from their standpoint. Again, they hear things that we don't. So if there's a terribly noisy environmental thing in your home, try to give the pet an opportunity to get away from that. And we don't even think about it sometimes. Put them in a very noisy environment, they're going to hear a lot more than we do. And it may be very disturbing. You know, there's a lot of noises out there that perhaps in the frequency, for instance, that we don't even know about. It's frightening what's going on. I mean, they may be picking up radio waves that we don't even know about. And that's a very difficult thing for us to control. But the things that you can control is just physically looking at your environment and saying, well, maybe he needs to be his bed put into a separate corner where it is not as noisy.
And the point behind all this is that we know that over time, all these little tiny stressors can develop into some health issues. Doctor, do you have a case that you could tell us about of an animal that came in exhibiting major problems that probably, you know, were stress-related, and kind of in a nutshell tell us, you know, of a particular circumstance where there was a wonderful recovery?
Well, the problem with that is I probably could spend the next week talking. I mean, practically.
You have a lot of them in your book.
Practically every case that I see come through the door is with a serious health problems. I shouldn't say every case I see. I see a few normals. I like to have the opportunity to see normals, but they come in with bad situations. But our cancer cases are we have wonderful, great success in at least approaching the cancer cases without the need for chemotherapy and radiation and that type of thing. And I'm not saying we cure all our cancer cases. That's ridiculous. But we do a really, I think, by complementary medicine, if you want to call it that. I don't particularly like that term, but anyhow, by the holistic approach to things, I think we can do a lot in our cancer cases. And I could tell you lots of happy cancer cases that really do well for a period of time. The case in mind, very briefly, is illustrated in the book, is an example of a dog that, you know, all of the stress factors that we've talked about and are in the book, I think this dog had them all. I mean, from a bad background, lousy food, over-vaccinated, too many drugs, you know, the whole shebang.
Oh, poor baby.
And it was about 11 years old and developed hemangiosarcoma, the splenic hemangiosarcoma. And lo and behold, and after a couple of ultrasounds, we decided to remove the spleen. And yes, it is a full-blown hemangiosarcoma. Usually the prognosis on that is probably 6 months at most, and they generally metastasize and they're gone. Anyhow, we went all out on this one, and he attended our book launch, and that was about almost 2 years afterwards. And I have to say, he did pass away, or she, it's a female, and she did pass away, but of kidney disease, just a few weeks ago. But she was 13, and knowing her background, I'm not surprised that she only lasted 13 years. But that was a case where we went out of our way and did get a good quality of life, at least as good as we could, for the last couple of years of her life. And I really feel good about doing that type of thing. But what I wanted to say about empathy
yes.
was that I think if people put themselves in their pet's position, I think the whole secret of it, of being a really conscientious companion for your pet is to put yourself in their position and try to empathize and realize that there are stress factors in their lives and your lives, and they reflect on your lives as well, and try to isolate them from that, that's those stress factors. Let's try our best to realize where the shortcomings are, and that includes, of course, spending more time and more effort in socializing with them. And that's the type of thing that they deserve.
My guest has been Dr. Paul McCutcheon. You'll find the links for how to order his book and his clinic's website on the full show notes for episode 104 at RaisingYourPaws.com. In the last episode, I promised I'd tell you what is considered to be the best game ever to play with your dog. First, I'll put it into the right perspective. Our domesticated dogs have adjusted very nicely to our human lifestyle. If they live in your house with you, they like sitting on the furniture. They ride in cars and look out the window just like we do, and they go into stores with us. And they would like nothing better than to eat what you are having for lunch. I think this lulls us into thinking they are like us, and we forget that their ancestors are wild animals, the wolf. And this means your dog still retains the instincts, behaviors, and some of the needs that wolves have. The more you can accept this and give them an acceptable outlet to meet their wild, wolfy needs, the happier your dog will be, and so will you. From the book 30 Days to a Well-Mannered Dog by Tamara Geller, she explains that the reason the game, whose name I will tell you in just a moment, is such a good one is because it meets many of your dog's hardwired needs. Like having your attention and companionship. The game is exciting, helps release pent-up energy, is physical, and gives them much-needed exercise. The rules of the game satisfy your dog's need to know his or her place. You are the leader, providing clear guidance and boundaries. The type of play engages your dog's instinctual skill of using its mouth and teeth to pull at pretend prey in order to kill it and tear it apart to get their meal. What is the game? Tug of war. This best game ever develops a strong bond with your dog, teaches them manners, allows them to safely express their wolf instincts while you still maintain control. And it is fun. As you know, all great games have rules, and properly played Tug of War has rules as well. You'll want to know the rules and teach them to your dog. Here they are. Rule 1. You must initiate the game and invite your dog to play. What if your dog does not know how to play Tug of War or doesn't seem interested? This is the case with my dog, Rosie. I'd love to play tug-of-war with her, but she doesn't really engage. Then I found out the right way to teach her the game. I can't wait to try this with her. You start by placing a sturdy, plush, squeaky toy on the ground next to your dog. They will be more interested if the game begins on the floor. This is where they are naturally hardwired to look for prey rather than the air around their head, which is where we usually try and wiggle the toy. Now pretend the toy is a small rodent and wiggle it around on the ground using jerking motions. Keep your eyes on the toy, not on your dog, and make happy noises the same way you would do with a baby. Act as if you would be so thrilled if your dog catches that pesky rodent. As soon as your dog tries even the lightest of tug, even with barely any pressure, let go of the toy and say, "You won!" in a praising tone of voice. You want your dog to feel like he's so strong that even a mild tug is enough to win the toy from you, even if it drops on the ground. Keep doing this, starting right away again, but this time the toy can be in your dog's mouth, not on the floor. See if you can tug a little bit more gradually, building up to tougher and stronger pulls, and he'll catch on in no time. A dog will be excited to play with you if it makes him feel strong and smart. If your dog is completely disinterested in the toy animal, you may have to build up his enthusiasm for it first. So keep the toy with you to take advantage of any situation when your dog is naturally excited, like when he first sees you coming through the door when you come home. Make a show of the toy and then reward him with a treat the moment he shows any interest in it. I do want to offer one caution about the game of tug of war. If you have a very aggressive dog that resource guards, this is not a recommended game. Rule 2. You have to win the game about 90% of the time. I know you just heard me say when teaching a dog how to play for the first time, it's necessary to let the dog win. This is because you're trying to show your dog that, one, you're a fun person to play with, and two, to prevent them from quickly getting frustrated or bored by a game that they feel they can't win. Once the dog knows and enjoys the game, then you are going to be the winner most of the time. You see, tug of war isn't just a fun, meaningless game. In a wolf pack, the tugging skill determines who gets the largest share of the meal and helps to determine the pecking order in the pack. This is why you need to win most of the time. It gives you a fun way to establish kind leadership without coming down too hard on your dog. You will let your dog win 10% of the time because no one likes to play a game he or she can never win. You'll want to lose to the dog just enough to keep him happy and interested, but not enough to challenge your role as the coach and leader of the team. Rule 3. Repeat the words play, play, play. You're teaching that this activity has a name. This way you can use it whenever you want your dog to come to you to play. Make sure you smile and moving your hand that is holding onto the toy from side to side in a smooth fashion. You don't want to jerk the dog's head, which can injure its neck. Rule 4. Have your dog drop the toy periodically. This is the part where you're teaching him manners and the rules. While grabbing at the toy might come very easy to a pooch, giving it up again may be harder for her to do. She needs to patiently be coached away from the instinct of hanging on to it with her dear life to being able to make a conscious choice to let go. You do this by practicing having the dog drop the toy throughout the game. It's kind of the same thing as when you're teaching a dog to come to you. You call them over, make them sit, give a treat, and let them go again. Your dog will get to keep playing tug, but she'll have to drop the toy on occasion in order to continue. If your dog already knows drop and instantly responds to this cue, that's great. It will be easier to put this into practice. However, if your dog is like Rosie and only follows the cue occasionally when she wants, you'll need to teach the cue drop within the confines of this game. Here's how to do that. You'll need to have some small pieces of a really high-value treat in your pocket or treat pouch. For Rosie, this means small pieces of string cheese. While your dog is hanging onto the toy, silently hold a high-value treat near its mouth. Most dogs will instantly drop the toy to make room in their mouth for the food. When she does, say drop and instantly give the treat. Then immediately ask her for a sit, and then say, take it. As you give the toy back to start another fun round of the game, you are creating an association that the word drop means pleasure of food and the opportunity to keep playing instead of the pain of loss of the toy and end of the game. After a couple times doing this, you should be able to get your dog to drop without a treat. Because for your dog, the real reward comes when he's got the toy back in his mouth and tugging away with you. If your dog just isn't interested in the treat and only wants to keep playing, there is a technique that Tamara Geller calls the bridge method in order to get them to drop the toy. I will explain how to do this in the companion blog for this week. You'll find that on our website, raisingyourpaws.com, blog number 104. Rule 5. At the end of the game, you wind up with the toy. This is another example of acting like wolves. If you allow your dog to hold on to the toy at the end of the game, he is going to think that he's won. So what, you may be thinking? What's wrong with that? But stay with this. It's important. The wolf instinct in your dog has him playing for points, so to speak, representing what would most likely happen in a real-life situation after a successful hunt. When two wolves are tugging for control of a piece of meat, the one that winds up with the chunk and gets to eat it has won. And that says something about their status. If you leave your dog with the toy at the end of the game, he's going to think you gave in and that he won the prize. This could lead to your dog looking for other privileges he can win, encouraging him to look for other opportunities to do things his way and not yours. But remember, you've taught the dog to happily drop the toy, so that still makes the experience pleasurable for your dog. Rule 6. End the game just before your dog is ready to quit. It's the old adage of always leave them wanting more. And the final rule, number 7, when you do end the game, say a release word. When you decide it's time to end the game, have a word to say and perhaps even a hand signal or gesture to go along with it. I say the words, "All done," while putting the palms of my hand together for a second and then rotating them out towards Rosie. It's a simple act, but it's like a gentle warning, a sort of shifting the energy down and stopping the play softly. That way your dog is not bugging or begging you to keep playing or too overly disappointed that the play ended abruptly. Having a sort of off switch lets them play freely, but allows you to stop the play and redirect the dog's focus with a few words. Then you can go for a walk or feed a meal or have a cuddle together. I will list the rules of tug of war on the companion blog for this episode 104, as well as what to do if your dog is being particularly stubborn about following the rule about dropping the toy. Tell me your tug of war stories by writing me at susan@raisingyourpaws.com. Thanks for listening.